This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. NASA's return to human spaceflight will not happen today. With less than 2.5 hours on the countdown clock, NASA scrubbed the launch of Space Shuttle Discovery for now. They blamed a faulty fuel sensor for the delay. The launch would have been the first since the Columbia mission that ended in disaster more than 2 years ago. Today's events highlight a renewed focus on safety at NASA since that event. This hour, we'll have an update from the Kennedy Space Center. We'll also hear from a member of the task force that investigated the Columbia accident, and we'll talk about NASA's future plans. If you have questions about the Discovery mission, about what NASA's done to fix its problems, or about the future of manned spaceflight, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to go now to Cape Canaveral and the Kennedy Space Center. Joining us there is NPR's Richard Harris. Always good to talk to you, Richard.
Likewise. Hi, Neil.
And also with us is astronaut Michael Full. Good of you to join us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Let's begin with Richard Harris. Richard, what caused the delay?
Well, they're still figuring out exactly what went wrong, but they know that there is a gadget on board the external fuel tank called the low-level fuel cutoff sensor. Basically, it says tank is empty when the tank is running very low on fuel. And there are four of them, and they like all four of them to be working, but one of them was registering tank is empty this afternoon when we know perfectly well the tank is full. So this is a problem, actually, that cropped up in April and caused considerable consternation back then, and they spent a lot of effort trying to fix it, and they thought they had fixed it. So it's really unclear what this portends for a delay, but we are not guaranteed another try tomorrow, that's for sure.
Because if they were previously worried that the weather might be a problem, I gather that didn't turn out to be a problem. But if they said if thunderstorms were in the area, they might have to punt until Thursday. Now, they're not scheduled to even announce what their plans are for, a couple of hours?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. What happened to the astronauts? They were already aboard the shuttle.
They were. They were being strapped in. They were smiling and happy. We could see pictures of them on closed-circuit television. Then all of a sudden the word came as the last one or last couple were about to be strapped in that, oops, problem. We got to fix something. And they were rather quickly unbuckled, sent back to their little silver van, and they were driven back to their crew quarters here. So staying away from germs and staying out of the hot sun as well in their big spacesuits. So.
Michael Full, let me ask you, you're a veteran of many launches. These sorts of things have to be, what's it like?
Well, the day begins with some expectation. Everyone's slightly excited. If it's your first flight, you're maybe a little more excited. Maybe you got a little less sleep. But people go out there in good spirits. You expect only good things to happen. You strap in and you get ready, and you're patient, and the experienced members of your crew remind you if you're a rookie or if you yourself have flown a number of times, you know that this may not be the day that you go into space. And this turned out to be one of those days for the crew. They'll be in good spirits now. They'll be relaxing, kicking back, so to speak, and I'll be waiting for the decisions that will be made in an hour and a half or so as to what should be done next as a result of this fuel cutoff sensor, false reading, and how to proceed from here.
Are the astronauts themselves part of the decision-making process? Are they up there busy doing stuff while they're waiting for takeoff?
It's very important, really, that the people making decisions about to launch or not to launch not be the astronauts. Astronauts, of course, have psyched themselves up, prepared themselves for a very long time in training to go, and so they would tend to make a more risky and a more go-oriented decision than the wiser heads that are in charge of the flight. And that's exactly what happened today in the Launch Control Center here at Kennedy Space Center. Managers have written down rules beforehand in calm, quiet meeting rooms many, many years ago, actually, about these fuel sensors, and decided that we need four of them. And so there weren't four, and so they decided to scrub.
Mm-hmm. Now, Richard, there was a scare, as I understand it, earlier this morning, another glitch of a sort, when a window cover fell off the shuttle.
That was yesterday afternoon, Neil. That's right. There was a window covers are on the windows on the top of the orbiter, and for some mysterious reason, one of them peeled free and fell about 65 feet and whacked into the orbiter down below, and it dinged a couple of tiles pretty seriously. The good news is that these particular tiles happened to be on a piece of material that was very easily removable and replaceable. They have spares. This is not that extraordinary a thing to have a tile damage and want to quickly swap them out. So that turned out to be a source of concern for a few minutes, but it quickly became evident that that was a very minor repair, and it was resolved in the matter of an hour. It's not at all clear that what we're looking at right now with this fuel sensor thing is something that can be troubleshooted in an hour and fixed. So,
but I wonder, doesn't that, I mean, this is like a 2-pound plastic window cover falling onto, doesn't that emphasize the fragility of the space shuttle?
Absolutely, the tiles are not entirely robust. It was one of the things that the review board was concerned about. How tough can you make the orbiter? And obviously, the tougher you make it, probably the heavier you make it, too. So there has to be a balance between how tough the skin is and how light it is. If you make it too heavy, you won't be able to get anything into orbit, and what's the point? So these are fragile tiles. They often get dinged up and they often get replaced, but that's sort of part of the accepted routine of the shuttle program, and it always has been.
We're talking with NPR's Richard Harris and with astronaut Michael Full at the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral. Again, if you're just joining us, the scheduled launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery has been postponed, scrubbed, and we're going to hear later today whether they will try to get it off tomorrow. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And this is Tom. Tom calling from Lee's Summit in Missouri.
Yeah, hi. I've got a great deal of respect for NASA, but I'm concerned about the way that they're operating right now. They've had 2 years to prepare for this mission, and at the last minute they have a piece of the thing fall off and damage tiles that were the cause of the last disaster. Had something go wrong today, and just things sitting on the launch pad seems to be falling apart. I know they're professionals. I know they're concerned about the safety of the crew and the safety of the craft, but I just don't understand how they can be that ill prepared.
Is this a matter of preparation, Richard?
Well, it's. I think things always happen. I think the truth is that we don't report most of them, but there are something like a little ding on a tile is something that happens all the time. And the fact is, yesterday there were 1,000 reporters here, and it happened at a very public time, and it was indeed an embarrassment because it was a reflection of what did bring down Columbia 2.5 years ago. So what I have seen is NASA trying very hard to really be careful and really to make their best efforts, because they don't want to lose astronauts any more than anybody else does. That's for sure.
That's for sure. And Michael Full, everybody, I think, at this point would edge towards better safe than sorry.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I've always been happier when I've launched. I've launched 6 times. I'm 5 times in the space shuttle, once in a Soyuz rocket. I'm happier actually after the first scrub, because then I get the feeling that the whole launch team, everybody that's come from all over the country here to launch us into space, have really got their act together. They've learned how to install the work platforms or take them away. They've known how to go through the procedures slightly better. It's actually a sort of a dress rehearsal that we've just been through today. And it will make for a safer and a more reliable launch the next time we try.
I have a follow-up question. Is the age of these spacecraft a problem? And I know it's not in the long range to operate that fleet anymore, but is there any plan to replace Columbia?
No, there's no plan to replace Columbia. In fact, there's an active discussion now to identify how many flights we will fly off the space shuttle system, and that's basically the Discovery and the Atlantis spacecraft through about the year 2010. And then NASA plans to stop flying the space shuttle and to transition to the Crew Exploration Vehicle, a vehicle that will allow us to not only go to Earth orbit, but to leave Earth orbit and set up a moon base and then on to Mars.
Okay, you didn't answer part of my question. Is the age of these spacecraft a problem?
I don't know specifically the age of all the components in the space shuttle system. I know it was certified for 100 flights for each vehicle originally, but we know that the space shuttle system itself hasn't lived up to some of the promises of the design back in the 70s. people do inspections on a regular basis. I fly in T-38 aircraft that weren't designed to fly for 30, 40 years, but that's what we're doing because of the inspections and the new techniques we apply to them. I think we're going to do the same thing with the space shuttle until 2010.
Tom. I can add into something on that, which is that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board said that they were concerned about the aging of the space shuttle fleet, and that's why they said they didn't really want them to keep flying past 2010 unless they were completely recertified, which is a daunting task. So that's why NASA is so anxious to have a replacement as soon as possible.
Michael Full, before we let you go, I did want to ask you, you mentioned that one Soyuz launch in Russia. There are thousands of reporters at Cape Canaveral, live television. How does the hoopla compare between when you're an astronaut at Canaveral and in Russia?
Well, there are differences. In particular, the launch site in Kazakhstan, at Baikonur, is more remote than Florida near Disney World, here at the Kennedy Space Center. So the access is more difficult in Russia. However, we have a lot of media there. We do have a few NASA personnel and management personnel, a few astronauts supporting those crews who are actually launching, looking after the families that have come to watch. The traditions going out to the launch pad are different. Here, when you go out to the launch pad about 3 or 4 hours beforehand, you see all these vehicles leaving because it's a dangerous place. You see all the blue lights and sirens going in the opposite direction. In Russia, everyone's going out to the launch pad, kind of gather around the launch platform and actually wave to you as you climb up onto the gantry and then into the lift to go up to the top of the rocket. But, of course, as we get closer to the countdown, they do clear the launch pad in Russia also, and it then resumes to, in a way, rather similar to that of a space shuttle launch.
Well, Michael Full, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Richard Harris, I expect we'll be hearing from you later today here on NPR News as we learn more about what's happened today and what's going to happen with the space shuttle Discovery in the next hours and days.
Indeed, yes.
Thanks very much, Richard. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
NPR's Richard Harris and Michael Full joined us from the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral. We're going to go to a short break, and when we return, we'll focus on talking about safety issues at NASA, on the lessons of the Columbia disaster, and the future of manned spaceflight. Our number, 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the now postponed launch of the space shuttle Discovery. No word yet on when it may go back up. For an explainer on how NASA decides when to launch a space shuttle, you can visit our website at npr.org. If you'd like to join our conversation as we focus on the lessons of the Columbia disaster almost 2.5 years ago and on the future of manned spaceflight, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida is Stephen Wallace. He was a member of the independent group that looked into the Columbia shuttle accident, and he's also head of the Office of Accident Investigation at the Federal Aviation Administration. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You've looked into a number of technical issues on the shuttle. Do we know enough about what happened today with this sensor to think about whether that's a significant problem?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but it was clearly a no-go item. This is a sensor, as I understand it, and this is not something that we particularly worked on the accident investigation at all. So it's all new to us today. But this is a sensor that senses the low fuel in the external tank, which is feeding the space shuttle main engines. And I think what it does fundamentally is it prevents those engines from running dry and possibly causing severe damage. So it's a critical component. I think there are four of them. There's a lot of redundancy. One of the four apparently failed. They will not take off, even though they don't strictly need it. If one of them failed after liftoff, they could deal with it, but they would not depart without that margin of safety. So it looks like it was a very clear call they had to make today. Disappointing, but clear.
Let's look at the program overall. As a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, the board proposed a number of, I think it was 18 changes that they thought were necessary. Have all of those been implemented?
Some of the recommendations, most of the ones that were of a physical nature that dealt with the physical cause of the accident, were return to flight items. And then there's another group that are organizational longer term. They've actually done a very good job, although I will say that the Columbia Board did not police the implementation of its own recommendations. Rather, a separate group, the Staff Recovery Return to Flight Group, did that. In some cases, the letter of specific recommendations they were not able to comply with, but they, in many cases, took other steps to mitigate the risk, did more in some areas than the board had asked for, and perhaps fell a little bit short of the mark, even with very good efforts in some other areas. On balance, I think they did a very good job at trying to manage the inherent risk of the flight.
Well, going back to the proximate cause of the Columbia disaster, the foam that fell off, one of the accident board's recommendations was, hey, there shouldn't be any debris coming off the main fuel tank that could fall into and damage the shuttle orbiter. They were not able to comply with that.
Well, of course, they eliminated the specific culprit, which was the bipod ramp. That entire structure is gone now with the new design. The insulation function of the bipod ramp was essentially made unnecessary because they put a heating device there instead. So that piece is gone entirely, and they have done, I think, a very thorough job at getting imaging, both via cameras on liftoff, cameras that are on the ground, cameras that are on the tank and the boosters, and then the capability to use the arm to inspect the entire structure for damage. So they've done a lot of steps to mitigate both, of course, the likelihood that anything will strike the orbiter, and also they will have the ability to assess any damage and a limited capability to repair it.
Limited capability to repair it. There's also a capability now, if they're going to the International Space Station, to have people on the space station take a look at parts they can't see to make sure that there's no damage.
That's correct. So that's both the two aspects of the space station. One is they have a maneuver where they can image it from the space station, as you mentioned. And the other is they have a safe haven capability, which is one of the risk mitigation strategies that is somewhat apart. It's apart from the repair capability, where they were not able to get a repair capability that could cover every situation. I think they've made a very good effort, but a part of their risk mitigation strategy was the capability to remain at the space station as a safe haven.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Adam. Adam calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. You know, my concern and my question is, even after reading everything that I have and had listened to your program and other programs, is I'm unclear and uncomfortable with the fact that we are still using the shuttles, and we don't seem to have a clear future for what we should replace it with, and also the fact that it would seem to me in any prudent field when you're trying to plan for the future is you don't wait until you take them out of service to start moving forward on stealth. So you have something in place and ready to go before you take the current item out of service. So my concern, and I guess my question is, what is the plan for the future, and what is the plan to focus with the future vehicles to make them much more safe than the current shuttles are?
That's getting more into policy areas as well. Stephen Wallace, I know that vision and political goals were part of the accident board's recommendations as well.
Well, the caller has asked an excellent question, and I think that the new NASA administrator, Mike Griffin, has really focused on exactly that point. The shuttle, clearly its task, essentially I believe its sole remaining task, is to see through the construction of the International Space Station, which is a huge international effort in which many nations have taken tremendous pride. Yet it is expected to retire the space station shuttle at about 2010. The space shuttle payload bay is the defining dimensional criteria for most of the major components of the space station, and so the shuttle will need to see that through. At the same time, I know that the current administrator very much has the same exact concern expressed by the caller, which is that we shouldn't be waiting to get the next vehicle, which they're calling the Crew Exploration Vehicle, which is not yet well-defined and has a broad number of missions. I heard the administrator this morning. He spoke to us and you know, is clearly committed to further, committed to human space flight, returning to the moon, to Mars, and beyond. Those were his words.
Let me also bring Marcia Smith into the conversation here. She's a space policy analyst with the Congressional Research Service and was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for inviting me.
And as you're looking at some of these policy issues that Adam raised in his phone call, what's the plan?
President Bush announced a new plan for space exploration in January of 2004, and he directed NASA to focus its human exploration program on going back to the moon and on to Mars, and in that process to discontinue the shuttle around 2010 and to build a new vehicle, this crew exploration vehicle that other guests have been talking about. Mike Griffin has made a priority out of accelerating the availability of that new vehicle. Under the earlier plan, it wasn't going to be ready until 2014, so there would have been a gap between when the shuttle ended and the new vehicle came along. And Dr. Griffin wants to narrow that gap as much as he can. But it is going to be some sort of new design. They haven't finalized it yet, and it's going to take some time to develop. So he would like to have it available in 2011. We're going to have to wait and see whether that's achievable or not.
Mm-hmm. Adam, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. Marcia Smith, let me follow on with you. And I also want to ask Stephen Wallace about this. One of the major issues raised by the Columbia Accident Board was NASA's culture, a feeling of complacency, of a place where ideas that bubbled up at the bottom, concerns and doubts, couldn't find their way to the top. Have those been addressed? Have those been dealt with? Marcia, why don't we begin with you?
Very difficult to measure culture and whether or not changes have in fact taken place, and different people have different views about it. NASA hired a consultant, BST, to help them deal with these cultural issues. And when Mike Griffin came in as administrator, he decided to terminate the contract with that company because he felt that NASA could handle it itself from now on. And there are some people who think that, yes, NASA can handle it. There are other people who think that you really need an outsider looking in at you because you may not even perceive that there are problems. So I think that it remains to be seen as to how these cultural changes are going to occur.
Stephen Wallace, are you satisfied those cultural changes have gone ahead?
Well, I agree with Marcia that this is a longer term is a difficult thing to readily assess. I will say that there are organizational recommendations, one in which I'm particularly pleased with the progress is the establishment of an independent technical authority, which basically separates the ownership of the safety standards and the right to waive them from the people who are really under the pressure to operate the program. And NASA, under the leadership of Rex Jevedin, has done an excellent job in putting that concept into place. And that is, to me, an organizational change which really has a very strong element of a cultural change as well.
Stephen Wallace, thank you very much for joining us today. I know you're busy. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Stephen Wallace was a member of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board and is director of the Office of Accident Investigation for the Federal Aviation Administration. Joined us by phone from the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral in Florida. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Mike. Mike calling from Hillsboro, Missouri.
Yes. Thank you, Neil. Nobody ever seems to raise the question of why would we try to send humans to Mars. It seems to be the cost would be so much higher than the value, when clearly we've seen that robotics have done tremendous things. I mean, clearly there's an agenda in the whole space program to maintain human spaceflight because it's what we do. And I mean, I'm an older guy, and I've been excited about the space program for years, but when will this end where we try to push man, physical man, further into space at just astronomical cost?
And as we're experiencing a frustrating delay in the launch of Discovery, I think Spirit and Opportunity, those plucky little robots, are still working on Mars, Marcia.
Right. We're hyper safe now. We're much safer than we were at the start of the space program. I mean, we're raising the level of safety and consequently the cost. And, I mean, it seems like we have to take some risk, but the risk of sending man to at the assurity level that we're trying to get to Mars, we just probably can't do it without just, you know, unbelievable cost and very little real scientific result.
Marcia?
There are people who think that it is humanity's destiny to reach out into space and to move off of planet Earth. At least a subset of humanity would move off of planet Earth. And I think that there has been an inherent belief amongst many of the people involved in the human spaceflight program that this is going to happen, and it's more a matter of who is going to go rather than whether or not humanity will ultimately move out to Mars and even beyond there. But there has been a long-standing debate, it goes back to the beginning of the space program, as to the whole robots versus humans debate and whether or not you couldn't do these things less expensively and more safely if you simply use the robots. And certainly the public imagination has been captured by Spirit and Opportunity and their predecessors. So there is a public interest in the robotic spacecraft, but most of the people who seem to be in charge of NASA's policy think that there is a desire on the part of most people to see Americans and others move out into space.
Mike, thanks for the call. We're talking about manned spaceflight and its future after the Columbia disaster and the impending liftoff of Discovery. Again, today's launch has been postponed if you're just joining us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest is Marcia Smith of Congressional Research Service. And it's important, you were talking about the focus, the renewed focus, because one of the criticisms of the space shuttle program and the International Space Station was that it didn't really lead anywhere. And that was the political decision taken by President Bush to refocus the program on, all right, use the shuttle to finish the International Space Station, but the goal has to be to return people to Mars and to the moon and then back to Mars. We now have a goal. But that has come at a price. There are other things that are not going to happen because resources are going to be devoted to that vision.
When President Bush announced his new vision for space exploration about a year and a half ago, he did not add a lot of money to NASA's long-term budget to do it. He had basically $1 billion over 5 years. And he told NASA that NASA was going to have to find the money from within its other programs. So there is a lot of concern that if it's earth sciences or those robotic space science missions that we were talking about, or NASA's aeronautics program, the first A in NASA's aeronautics, that those programs were going to have to suffer in order to come up with the money in order to do this new human exploration initiative. The current head of NASA, Dr. Griffin, keeps emphasizing that he is not going to rob Peter to pay Paul, basically, but it's yet to be determined where the money is going to come from to accomplish this, especially since he does want to accelerate the development of this new shuttle replacement, the Crew Exploration Vehicle. And people from the various space science and aeronautics disciplines are very concerned that their budgets will suffer in order to achieve this.
Not to mention the astronomers. One of the programs that was scrubbed was revisits to the Hubble Space Telescope, which needs servicing if it's going to be able to stay up and continue to be a stable camera platform. And, because it's not on the way to the International Space Station, and because of safety, they want all the shuttle flights to go there, it's not going to be revisited, and it's likely to fall into the ocean, in a couple of 3 years?
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope is actually kind of an interesting case. The decision as to whether or not to send the shuttle to Hubble, to service Hubble, was really not so much based on cost as it was on a concern about shuttle safety, because the then head of NASA, Mr. O'Keefe, felt that if you sent a shuttle to the Hubble, you would not have the space station as a safe haven in case something went wrong. So that was sort of the impetus for his decision to cancel the servicing mission, which has been very controversial, and Congress has put money back into NASA's budget to do a servicing mission. And the new head of NASA, Dr. Griffin, has said that he will relook at that decision after return to flight, and he has a better understanding of the safety aspects of the shuttle now that it's been fixed.
Let's see if we can get another caller in before the break. This is Wesley. Wesley calling from Kansas City.
Thank you very much for taking your call. Very interesting subject. I'm surprised that no one has mentioned the commercial spaceflight industry, even though it's in a fledgling state, seems to be having more successes than NASA. And I was wondering if possibly one reason why we're not hearing a lot of new plans about introducing new forms of transportation is possibly because the commercial industry is moving into that area.
And I'm going to have to ask for an answer in about 30 seconds, Marcia Smith.
NASA is very interested in commercial space opportunities, and of course there is a large commercial space market out there for launching communication satellites and other satellites. So there is a lot going on in the commercial area, and I think that NASA is looking to take advantage of that.
Wesley, a good question. Thanks for the phone call. We appreciate it. Sorry we didn't have more time to address it, but we're running out of time in this segment. Appreciate it. And we'd also like to thank Marcia Smith, Space Policy Analyst with the Congressional Research Service, for joining us here in Studio 3A. We appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And when we come back from a short break, we're going to take a look at Michael Chertoff's plans to overhaul the Department of Homeland Security. And we'll talk about an end in sight to the labor wars in hockey. The whole season was lost. It looks as if an agreement may be within reach. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.